Before she closed down this group, this was back in February of 2021, I mentioned it. Hey, I've got a podcast. I just started it. Come on over. It's called Life After Sugar. Bang, I got 300 people, 300 downloads that day.
Most hosts never achieve the results they hoped for. They're falling short on listenership and monetization, meaning their message isn't being heard and their show ends up costing them money. This podcast was created to help you grow your listenership and make money while you're at it. Get ready to take notes. Here's your host, Adam Adams.
And we're back with another episode of the Podcast on Podcasting. Thank you for being here, podcasters. Today, we're going to be talking to someone that has started a podcast and got 100,000 downloads in 1 year. And that's wonderful because I'm hoping that I can extract some of the things that she's doing that's allowing her to be able to get to 100,000, because you know what the average is? And Netta, do you know?
I don't. Tell me.
Most people hit 10,000 downloads after 1 or 2 years. That's the normal. So it was your first year that you already hit 100,000. Is that right?
Yeah, just over a year. Yes.
Okay. If you're listening and you're like, Adam, tell me more about Netta. Her bio is in the show notes. You can scroll right down. But there's a couple of interesting things that I'll start mentioning now. We're going to derail our podcasting conversation for a minute to talk about sweets or the lack of sweets. Now, her podcast is called Life After Sugar. Life After Sugar. It took her 45 years. She was doing like the 3 meals a day like everyone is taught. She is in Canada, but in the US, we're certainly taught that too. 3 square meals. They got to be square. They got to have a lot of breads and they've got to have fruits and vegetables. You know, it's funny. The reason that I was excited to talk with you, a reason, because there's more than one, is because lately I've been doing a lot of fasting, intermittent fasting. Sometimes I'll skip a few days. Sometimes I'll try to see what my body does. If I only eat meat for a certain amount of time, only eat sardines, which people are like, yuck, but I actually like them now. Only eat sardines. Or I've even tried a fruitarian diet. It was only like 6 days that I could last. I had to eat something else. But do you mind sharing just a bit of that background, kind of what got you into doing Life After Sugar and eating the way that you eat now and kind of what that looks like? Only because it's interesting. Not everybody does it. And I think it'll definitely help us understand why you started your show.
Well, here's the thing. I have absolutely no background in nutrition or health and wellness or anything like that. You can hear I'm originally from England and I teach English as a second language in a French-speaking town in Quebec, Canada. Well, the whole of Quebec is French-speaking and I live in French. I work in English. This has nothing to do with my business. I'm a teacher. This is as far away from a business person as you can get in mindset. The thing was that for my health, I never had a weight problem, but I had a lot of digestive issues. Won't go into the details, but let's just say chronic constipation was one of them. The problems that I had, I was told to do all sorts of things, up my fiber intake, especially, and none of it was helping. It was actually getting worse and worse. By the time I was 45, I was going to the bathroom like once a week. I was just in pain, bloated, aches and pains everywhere. And it was suggested to me by a nutritional therapist to cut sugar, one of the things, and flour and sweeteners. I mean, that's pretty much like 90% of food on the shelves, to see if it could help. There were other issues that we also addressed, but this is one of the things. So she suggested this to me back in 2015. I was 45. And I said, no, no, thank you. What, are you crazy? Who would do something like that? So I resisted it and I rejected it for the longest time. What happened was that I wasn't feeling any better. And so it was really either do something that you've never tried before or carry on with what you've been doing and feel, no pun intended, but feel like crap. I ended up trying what she said for just 2 weeks, cutting out all forms of refined sugar, flour, and sweeteners for 2 weeks. Because I thought, well, you can do anything for 2 weeks. So that was, long story short, after those 2 weeks. First week, I felt awful. And I sort of had detox symptoms, as it were, which I wasn't expecting because I didn't know what the heck I was letting myself in for. Second week, I started feeling much better, much more energetic. The few pounds that I did have to lose started melting off me. I just felt like I was going back in time and feeling younger. Again, you know, I was writing on my Facebook wall just to sort of keep myself accountable, and I kept doing that. And after a while, I started teaching about it because I'm a teacher. And I started giving in-person workshops. That this was way before COVID. And this was in French. I gave them at my college. It wasn't online. I didn't even know such a thing existed as teaching online. And so slowly but surely, I started doing this. And then I was on sabbatical one semester and I made a website, which sounds easier said than done. And then I got into the press, into the newspapers and TV and stuff. And then that things sort of snowballed from them. This is all in French in Quebec. And I ended up thinking, you know, I could help a lot of people by talking about my own experience and teaching them about not just about how sugar affects your body, but how to actually stop eating sugar. You don't just stop and think it's going to be an easy ride. So that's how it all started.
When we talk about sugar, do you drink alcohol?
Very, very little. I've never been a drinker. Alcohol doesn't like me very much. And it takes a few sips of red wine for me to actually feel. So I keep it to very, very low amount and really always have. But even less alcohol, it takes even less alcohol to make me feel awful now than it used to.
How about fruit? Is fruit a thing you should eat or shouldn't eat? You're trying to eat?
Yeah, for me, it's not a question of should or shouldn't. It's a question of want or don't want. And I always say that I eat as much fruit as I want whenever I want. The thing is, I hardly ever want any, and only a little bit satisfies my taste buds that have become so, so sensitive to sweet foods, sweet taste, that I don't actually enjoy the sweet tastes anymore. So I'm not running after them.
Very interesting. If you decided to, well, it's not a decision because you said the way that you find out if you're going to be eating or not is just when you're hungry, you will. So let's just say that you only eat one meal today. Today, let's pretend it's going to be one meal. What time might that be? And what do you think you might eat?
Usually it's in the evening because that's when I'm with my family and it's eating is a social, as much as social as a nutritional event. Usually just keep it for the evening. Not that they would particularly care if I just sat with them and didn't actually chew and didn't eat, you know. So I would eat pretty much what they're eating because I'm the cook in the house, although my husband's actually a better cook, but I'm the one that can manage my time to cook up in between work and school and everything else. So I would eat a piece of protein and I'm a meat eater. So it would be, you know, a steak or a stew or I don't know, some curry, whatever it is that I make with some vegetables and a sauce. I love sauces, you know, so I like to sort of vary creamy sauces. And that would be my meal, a big full plate.
Got it. So it's not your business, people, this or doing these workshops.
It has become my business. I registered my business a year ago, switched to the English language because, you know, it's just a bigger audience. I've taken down my teaching task to half time and the other half of my week, or rather the other. It's like 50% teaching and 80% business because it's a lot of hours to set up a business and do it properly. So it is a business. Am I replacing my teaching salary? Not yet, to be honest.
Okay. So that was about a year ago, sounds like, that you decided to make it a business. You were already teaching people a couple of years before that, but you decided to make it a business about a year ago. Podcast then.
I started the podcast. I hit publish on the 31st of January, 2021, because I'd made a pact with myself to get it out there by January, 2021. I could see that, you know, I kept putting it off and the 31st of January was a Sunday. Last day of January, I just hit publish and I published three episodes at the beginning.
Three at the beginning. Why did you do that?
That was what I'd been advised to do. I'd done a trailer, I think the December before, and then I prepped three episodes and started with that.
The trailer and the three episodes all came out about the same time?
No, the trailer was in the December before.
Okay. You were advised to do that. I actually tell our clients, we help podcasters too. We tell them to get a few ready to go. We always say you want to publish, you know, your trailer about a week before your launch day. On your launch date, you want to have at least three published that one day. There's a lot of reasons why. And then we don't even get started with a client in knowing when their launch date is until they also have a month's worth of content ready to go. So they might record, let's say they're going to do one a week. They might record 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 total episodes, and then we know, all right, we're ready to get this going. But I won't say all of the reasons why, because I'd like you to say how it worked for you and also maybe what this advice that you were getting, what were the reasons behind them saying that you should have three on day one?
The advice that I was getting for the trailer was to be able to sort of have time for all the different platforms to accept me, and to, some of them are longer than others. So that was the thinking behind more than a week, like a good month before actually starting the three episodes. The three episodes, it was because to get a little bit more traction as well, because you're going to get more downloads when you have three episodes out there than when you just have one. And also to have more of an idea for the listeners of what it is that you're actually talking about, so that they're not listening to one subject and then they have to wait for another week before they hear about the other subject. So for me, it was sort of three different subjects, the type of sugars, the what do you eat, you know, whole episode about what I actually eat, which is completely mysterious to many people, as it was for me as well. And I think the third episode was really the backstory of Life After Sugar, which was my story. And I was being interviewed by a friend of mine who interviews people for a living. So that she offered to do that. And then, yes, I did have several recordings lined up as well, because I found that I'm sort of addicted to interviewing people. I love it.
I was originally wanting to ask you on these first three episodes if they were solo episodes or if they were you interviewing somebody else. And it sounds like it was a third option. I was like, is it A or B? And I was ready to ask that, but it sounds like it was C, where your friend actually interviewed you on those first three episodes.
Just on the first episode, just on one of the three, okay. She interviewed me, the backstory, so okay. That it's not just me talking about myself all the time. And the other two were solo episodes. And sort of my idea, and the idea you have at the beginning then morphs into something completely different. That was the case for me. My idea was to have solo episode 1 week and an interview the following week and sort of alternate like that. But I just got so carried away with all the interviews that I ended up doing over a year, I would say about 5 solo episodes. And all the others were interviews with regular people who had cut down or cut out sugar and talked about how wonderful they feel.
Good stuff. A lot of different stuff. Cutting out sugar, is this a keto diet or am I off on the wrong path saying that?
Well, funnily enough, I have a whole podcast episode, a solo okay. one that is called Are You Keto? No, I'm Netta. Because I do not like to identify myself with what I eat or any kind of eating pattern. I won't be sort of put in a box like that. So the short answer is no, it's not keto. I'm not keto and I don't eat keto. The long answer is in the whole episode.
Cool. And so your podcast, Life After Sugar, is in our show notes. So the listener can just like scroll down and click and jump over there. And also, it sounds like you said you started a website, although it was harder than you thought to start that website, but it is there. So we'll link to that website also in the show notes so people can check it out. One of the things that you said about your podcast and your podcast growth and getting to like 100,000 downloads in a year, you mentioned that it snowballed after getting press.
My podcast. That was all in French. That's nothing to do with my podcast. Okay. My podcast is in English. Sorry.
Okay. What snowballed after getting press then?
Yeah, that was just people getting onto my website in French. That's what snowballed. But that website no longer exists. I shut down everything in French. And now I have another website in English called aftersugarclub.com, and that hasn't snowballed yet.
Okay. The reason that I brought it up is because I wanted to find out how you got on the press. Did you have a publicist? Did somebody make a bunch of connections? Did you reach out to TV outlets? Or did just one person pick you up and then it just blew up on its own pretty much organically? How did that work? I mean, I think the listener might want to try to do the same thing.
Okay. So you have to remember this is in French speaking Quebec, very small population, you know, only in French. And I just knew a guy from town who was a journalist. And I didn't even have to pitch myself. We just already knew each other because it's a small town that I live in. What I didn't know when we had our interview is that he actually worked for a bigger newspaper than just our local newspaper. So I didn't even know I was in the press until a friend of mine who's also a journalist wrote to me and said, oh, did you know you're in the papers? And I was like, oh, I didn't know. And then once you're in the papers, then the TV picks up on it. And then I was on the radio. It only lasted for a week, but it was enough to have like 800 people sign up for my newsletter within 48 hours. So it was relatively overwhelming at the time. But after that, I didn't know what the heck to do with these people anyway. So yeah, I wasn't expecting to make business, or I didn't know what I was doing. Quite frankly, did not know what I was doing. I know a little bit more now. The irony is that I'm not snowballing because I haven't been in the English speaking press yet, because I'm still working and I can't do it all. I've got a family. But if anyone's wondering, you know, how do I get traction with press? For me, it was who you know, way more than pitching, just sending out cold pitches.
I was reading a book. I'm having a hard time remembering the author. It's called Who, Not How.
I've just finished reading that.
Reminds me of what you're talking about, how you knew the right person. And a lot of us, when we're like, okay, I need to get in the press, and they're going to first think, how am I going to do that? And in that book, he talks a little bit about who do I need to connect with so that this happens? And you don't have to be the one to basically do it. And I thought that was interesting. And you brought that up. So you just finished the book?
I just finished reading that book. Yes.
Well, yeah. I'll make sure that we link to it in the show notes of this episode. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. I did the Audible version. Did you have the paperback version?
Or? Yes. I'm of the generation of paper books.
I don't know what generation I am in, but I will say that I'm dyslexic. So the last thing I want to do is sit and look at Word.
Fair enough. And I'm a literature teacher, so books
there
are
you
my
go.
Thing.
There you go. With your podcast, you started it around the same time that you were starting to make this more of a business. And what is kind of your 1 year, 2 year, 3 year picture? Where is this all going to go? What are you planning on? And what takeaways would a listener be able to have to making something out of their passion like you are?
Yes. Yes. Well, first of all, I didn't have real strategy or plan for my podcast. So I never expected to have these types of numbers. So that was the first thing, which I suppose kind of saved me because I just let it run. For my business, I'm hoping to be able to have it replace my salary, my teacher's salary, which doesn't take much doing. But, you know, it's a longer and far more difficult path to get an online business up and running and getting traction. Personally, much harder journey than I would ever have imagined, and much longer than I would have thought. So, you know, you've got to have a bit of a reality check. So my podcast has taken off, but that doesn't mean that my business has taken off. There's actually not necessarily, financially speaking, any relation between the two. My podcast is really not making me a penny in that I don't have sponsors yet, and it's not making me direct money, but it's giving me a name and credibility in this niche.
I need to do the math because you've published around 60 episodes or so as of the time we are recording, just over it. And so 100,000 divided by 60, it's almost 2,000 people listening to each episode. And I'm sure it's growing. So some of the newer ones might be above that.
Yes.
It sounds like it's doing really well. And you mentioned that you're not currently monetizing the show.
Exactly.
As a podcast consultant myself, somebody who's helped a lot of people to make money on their show, I believe that you're in a good position to be able to have a sponsor right now. I think of like all of these sponsors that are out there, and maybe they used to go to events, or maybe they're back at events now that we're getting past COVID and stuff. But with those sponsors, sometimes they're going to spend, let's say, $15,000-$25,000 to sponsor one event that has only 300, 600, 1,000 people. And now you've got 2,000 people listening to every single one, I think it's a natural transition for somebody like that to want to align with your audience. So I think you're right there, Netta.
Thank you.
I think you could do it this week if you put your thought into that. You mentioned that growing the business was a hard/long journey, longer than you thought or harder than you expected. I want to talk a little bit about what you're learning along the way, because it'll be valuable to anyone else. Because it'll be valuable to anyone listening. And I might first mention that there's this saying that I'm going to botch. It sounds something like this. We generally overestimate what we can do in a year, but we underestimate what we could do in 5 years. What I'm seeing with you right now and anyone else probably launching a business is we expect we hope that we're a millionaire overnight. We launch the podcast or we start the business and we immediately replace our income. But sometimes it takes 1, 2, or 3 years for most people to get to a place where they're in the black finally. It's something where they can feel comfortable leaving their job, for example. And in 5 years, you might just be amazing place that you're, you know, looking back at this overnight success being 5 years long or whatever. But what takeaways have you learned that specifically were hard or long for, you know, launching either the business or the podcast for you?
Yes, more for the business than the podcast. So for the business, I think it didn't even cross my mind what a huge mindset shift was required of me from being a teacher in an academic college situation with, you know, all my diplomas and everything and students who have to be there and pass the course if they want their diploma. So I don't have to convince them of anything or sell them anything. They're just there and I do my thing and, you know, and I feel competent teaching. And then I get into this business world where I just naively thought I'm going to transfer my teaching skills to the business world, teach everybody about sugar, and I'll be a millionaire, as you were saying, you know, within a year. I can laugh at it now. But honestly, I go through bouts of like almost depression about it because it is so different from my reality as a tenured academic teacher. And it's like everything I'm good at, I feel, is completely useless in the business world because it doesn't matter what I know. People who are looking to drop sugar, first of all, nobody wants to drop sugar, nor did I, right?
Of course not. It's too delicious.
It's too delicious.
And we're addicted to it.
Absolutely. So I'm selling something that nobody wants in that sense.
I love it. I love it. You're Alaska selling snow to the Eskimos or something.
Or something like that. Exactly. And already business is difficult. But if you're also selling something that no one's out looking for, it's like shooting yourself in the foot. So that's one thing. And then the other thing was just, you don't just tell people, hey, I've got this thing to sell, like my online course or my membership, which I have both, right? You don't just go around saying, yeah, I got this thing, buy it. And then people flocking to buy it. It just doesn't work that way. And so I've been used all my career to telling the students, here's your homework, do your homework, here's the exam, pass the exam. And they just do it. They're docile, right? Because they want their diploma.
Yeah. 80, 90, 95% of the room is going to do the thing you ask them to do. And now you're at that 1% or something like that.
Exactly. So that I toppled down from my ivory tower. In fact, I think I'm still toppling, realizing that you can't just transfer from one reality to another, one paradigm to another. You just can't. So, and through it all, I've been sugar-free. So it's not like I'm using sugar as a crutch anymore to get through all this.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. So the podcast, though, has gotten traction because I found my people. Because I said to you, nobody wants to give up sugar, right? But except that you know how it works in business. You have a niche and then you have a smaller niche within that niche and then it gets smaller and smaller. So I'm not in just in the nutrition niche, and I'm certainly not in the keto niche because I'm not ketone. because the rules and regulations annoy me, if nothing else. I mean, and then yes, healthy eating, but not keto. And then that narrows it down even more. And then not this and not that. And I'm like, well, who's going to want to listen to me? Like, who's going to identify with that? And funnily enough, you were talking about fasting earlier on. It's the intermittent fasting niche that is the most receptive to what I have to say. And that was very surprising to me. You would have thought if people are not eating, then it doesn't matter what they're not eating. Doesn't matter if they're not, if they're not eating sugar or not eating anything else. But the fact of the matter is that when you do start intermittent fasting, you do tend to become more aware of what you're eating and the quality of what you're eating. And you tend to realize that, sugar is really throwing a spanner in the work. It's preventing you from fasting easily because it'll create blood sugar spikes and crashes and make you feel hungry. It's not real hunger, but it feels like hunger. So anyway, these people are way more into all the stuff that I talk about. And bingo, 100,000.
I think some of the times that I go to carbs, we'll say, mostly like breads and like desserts, is I might start to feel, what's the best way to say it? Depressed is not the right word. It's the only thing that I can think of. I start to feel like it would just be nice to have that food. It would comfort me, you know, maybe not depressed, but I want to feel that comfort, and that those chemicals do that to me. They make me feel good for a minute. And so I go to sugar sometimes. I definitely want to cut it out better. That's one of the reasons why I went to intermittent fasting, and probably why these people are your better like avatar, is because I'm thinking to myself, man, if I skip two meals, I can get into a little bit of ketosis, maybe not a keto diet, but I can start hitting that closely. And it can burn some fat, and then it will be less bad to eat that sugar. But now I'm thinking going another step. So I love it. A couple quick things, and then we'll wrap up our conversation today. I think I've got three things. Number one, I believe one of the reasons why you have been able to get your traction and find your people is because you drew your line in the sand. A lot of podcasters are afraid to draw a line in the sand. They're afraid to stand for something because they don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. They want everyone to listen to them. And so they try to attract everybody. And so they will jump on a podcast episode and they'll say, you can do whatever you want. It doesn't matter what you do. And nobody's going to be attracted to that. The first thing that I wanted to say is you've drawn that line in the sand, which is why I believe that you have found your people and gotten 100,000 downloads in a short amount of time. And it sounds crazy and counterintuitive that I'm going to say, I'm not keto. I'm not this. I'm not this. I'm not suggesting this. Because as you do that, people are listening and they're like, ooh, she's not keto. Why not? And then they start to listen and then they hear your wisdom, the differences and how you feel about it. And you're drawing your line in the sand and they're like, I can get behind this. I didn't want to do keto anyway. And so I believe that that's a helpful thing for anyone to take away. Number two is just that I'm glad that you found your people, and that's wonderful. And I hope that the listener finds their people too. And number three is I want you to tell me a question that you hope I would ask or you know would be valuable if I asked you.
Maybe where did I find these people?
Yeah, perfect. I love it. Where did you find these people?
Oh, I'm happy you asked. Thank you. Never thought of that one. Yes, I think also what your listeners may find valuable knowing is that sometimes you find your people in the least likely of places. And, you know, what you think is going to happen is 100% guaranteed not to happen in business and in life in general. Here I was thinking, you know, I don't like the keto people, but who else is there that is not eating sugar out there? I don't want to give diabetic people any advice because I'm not medically trained, but who else is there that needs to cut down sugar? Or on the other side of the scale, everybody needs to cut out sugar. So as you were saying, you know, I should be talking to everybody, but everybody is not your person. So I was naturally in some intermittent fasting groups because intermittent fasting came naturally to me. The less sugar I ate, the less hungry I got. And, you know, I had some interactions with the people there, and so you sort of get a little bit, you know, famous, as it were, in these groups. And the admin allowed me to mention my podcast one time in this group, this big group, which has since been closed down because Facebook doesn't agree with fasting, but that's another discussion and they'll close you down. So anyway, before she closed down this group, this was back in February of 2021, I mentioned it. Hey, I've got a podcast. I just started it. Come on over. It's called Life After Sugar. Bang, I got 300 people, 300 downloads that day. And that was the traction. That was the traction. Because then I went into smaller groups. It's not even the size of the group. That particular group was like 300,000 people. Now I'm in a group of 3,000 people, and yet the traction and the numbers are even bigger. Go figure.
I love it. That is such an amazing way to finish this episode. Seeing your traction when the average podcaster doesn't even hit 10,000, it takes them a year or two to hit 10,000. You were able to hit 10x that. And you weren't doing a bunch of paid marketing. The opportunity for you to get on the news outlets and newspapers didn't directly contribute to your podcast. That was another thing. And so the main thing that you were able to do to find your people is you went to groups or forums where there's a leader, and you're able to connect with the leader at some level for them to be comfortable with you adding value to others in different ways. And you did this on that main group that ended up getting shut down. That was a big one. And then a couple other group. It's this extra effort of you going on LinkedIn or Facebook or meetup groups, wherever you can find them, of your perfect avatar, of the type of person that wants to listen to your show. And you found a way to either speak at their events, get on their podcasts, or add value in their group. And that was what allowed you to hack into the whole network that followed them. And now your podcast is blown up.
Yep, that pretty much sums it up.
I love it. Netta, thank you for jumping on the show and sharing your journey and being honest with us and letting us know the pros, the cons, the hardships, the things that have gone well. Anybody, including my own self, definitely learned a thing or two on this podcast, and not just about our diet, but also about how to be a better podcaster. We really, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. And if you're listening and you want more of this content, boom, guess what? Every other episode is a solo episode. Every other episode is a interview episode. So just listen to the very next episode, get some more value for your podcast. And if I can do anything for you, go to growyourshow.com, schedule a call, and we'll start seeing how we can support your podcast. Bye for now. By the way, one way to ensure that you don't miss out on great content that we're producing on a regular basis is to make sure you're subscribed to the show. You need to be subscribed or following the Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to it in order not to miss all of that. And before I let you go, I need to mention, because a lot of people are asking, do you help? Can you help me with this? And the answer is yes. My company actually does it. It's called Grow Your Show. And you can find that at growyourshow.com. Our clients, they call us the easy button for podcaster, because they simply have to record their episode. And they know that every single thing else is done for them. We sweat the hard stuff so you can be the star of your show. And if you would like help to make sure that we're editing and publishing and promoting and doing your social media, it's all in one place. And I think it's pretty affordable. You'll have to take a look for yourself. Just go to growyourshow.com and check us out. And by the way, I'll see you on the next episode.